Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us any place that you can subscribe to podcasts. We have an interesting show today with, I would say, one of the least popular people in the Trump White House. There are a lot of unpopular people, but I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that that CNN is the most hated network in the Trump White House and the single most disliked correspondent working for CNN happens to be Jim Acosta, who has been described as an enemy of the people, which happens to be the title of his new book, and he joins us. So thanks for joining us, Jim.
Thanks, Charlie. Appreciate it.
Okay, so look, you know what your critics say about you. You portray yourself as somebody who is standing up, speaking truth to power, trying to get the news. And your critics, particularly in the Trump White House, but in that orbit, would say, nah, Jim Acosta is a self-promoting showboat. You're this guy. You've become part of the story. You are the guy who is making everything about yourself. So in a certain way, you are the perfect foil for Donald Trump. If Donald Trump had a laboratory where he was going to create an enemy of the people, it would look a lot like Jim Acosta. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I'll tell you, Charlie, I was raised in this business not to make myself part of the story. I've worked my way up in this industry. I worked in television news in Knoxville, Tennessee, Dallas, Texas, Chicago. Then I moved to CBS News and then to CNN. I've moved so many times. I have moving boxes with the moving stickers on top of the moving stickers from moving from one city to the next. And, you know, I really tried my best to keep myself out of the news. But, you know, this did happen January 2017. I'll take you back to that press conference. It was the press conference where the president-elect referred to me and my news organization as fake news. And remember why he did that. He was objecting to a story that was real news. CNN had broken the story that the intelligence community had gone to the president-elect and said, Mr. President, you may have a problem here. The Russians may have compromising information on you. And during that press conference, Sean Spicer, Mike Pence, and then Donald Trump all referred to that story as fake news. And my sense of it was sitting in that, in the chairs in the area where the press was sitting that day, was that he was trying to tell the world that up was down, black was white, real was fake. And I describe it in the book as a question of what would you do? Do you just sit there and take it, or do you try to do something? And I jumped in and interrupted and tried to get a question in. He wouldn't take my question and then he called me fake news. And it's sort of gone that way ever since. But, you know, my sense of it is, Charlie, is that, they can call us all the names that they want to call us. The president's defenders, I suppose, may not like us for that, but we have to keep doing our jobs.
You know, I remember this press conference, and it was a very interesting tactical move by the White House, because during the 2016 campaign, we had the emergence of fake news, which was, you know, literally propaganda hoaxes, stories that became viral. And there was a lot of debate about how are we going to deal with fake news. And then Donald Trump turned that around, you know, having been the beneficiary of the actual hoaxes, turned it around and aimed it at the news media. And that was kind of a whoa moment as part of his campaign to delegitimize all the independent sources of criticism. But, you know, you've watched the guy up close. So, and you've been asked this before, how much of this is just his shtick? Knowing that this is his tactic, it's obviously the red meat at all of the rallies. This is something that conservatives have been beating on for a very, very long time. He sort of raised it to a completely different level. How much of it is just tactical, and how much of it is real? I mean, how much of the loathing of the media is general? And you can break that into Donald Trump, who may be playing with it, but his base, which may be taking it very, very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, Charlie, I covered Donald Trump as a candidate, and I was at the rallies when he would call us the disgusting news media, the dishonest news media, liars, scum, criminals, and so on. And we would have thousands of people in these rallies yelling at us. And, you know, some of his supporters would come up to the press cage, as we called it, and scream a traitor at us. You know, you can find these YouTube clips. Don't take it from me. Yeah. And then he rolled that act into the Oval Office. And I'll take you to the press conference that he had in February of 2017, when he called me very fake news. Right after that press conference was over, as I write in the book, Hope Hicks, one of his top aides, called me. And she said, Jim, I just want you to know the president thought you were very professional today. And she said, and the president said, Jim gets it. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, he just called me very fake news 5 minutes ago, and now Hope Hicks is telling me that I get it. Yeah, obviously, Charlie, this was an act. This was a shtick. The problem is that the act has gotten out of his control. He's escalated things going from fake news to the enemy of the people. And my goodness, Charlie, right after a person sent a pipe bomb to CNN and various Democratic officials around the country last fall, the president continued to call us the enemy of the people. And so, you know, listen, I know there are folks out there who maybe think we take this too seriously, but I don't think we should stick our heads in the sand on this one. I think there are some Trump supporters out there, not all, certainly not all, but some, who absorb this hostility, absorb this rhetoric, and direct it back at us in ways that make us feel threatened and endangered. I get about a death threat a week now. They stream into my social media. I take snapshots of them, so I have a record of them. I've talked to the FBI about all of this. And so the question becomes, is this the kind of political culture we want to hand off to the next generation of Americans? My sense of it is we don't.
So what does the phrase the enemy of the people mean to you? Why did you make that the title of your book?
Well, I think part of the reason is I think this expression, which obviously predates Donald Trump, Stalin, and those types of dictators have used that expression before. But, you know, I think this expression that he has used to demonize the press will come to help define this era, because I think what the president has done, and I don't take any joy in saying this, is that he has turned pitting one group of Americans against another into an art form. It is his real art of the deal, the way he pits groups of Americans against one another for political gain. And he's demonized the press to the extent that now large, significant chunks of the Republican Party feel it's okay that the president describes us as the enemy of the people. I'm hopeful that with this book that people will hit the pause button and think deeply about whether or not this is the kind of political climate we want in this country. Because, Charlie, as I was saying before, we don't want a situation where somebody takes things too far. If somebody, God forbid, seriously hurts or kills a journalist in this country, we're no longer the United States of America that you and I grew up with. We then become a country that belongs to a different category of nations around the world, a category where journalists are no longer safe doing their jobs. My goodness, Charlie, towards the end of the midterm cycle, I had four bodyguards going with me to Trump rallies. Reporters shouldn't need bodyguards to cover Trump rallies or any political rally. The climate has gotten out of control, and we need to turn down the temperature.
Do you think this will happen? You're talking about very specific threats of violence, and I don't see this abating in any way over the next year. Do you think there will be acts of violence, attacks on reporters?
Well, there already have been. There was a BBC cameraman who was attacked at a Trump rally in El Paso earlier this year. As a matter of fact, when I was over at the BBC yesterday, I talked to him, and he described what happened to him. He said that a Trump supporter essentially jumped onto the press riser and started pushing him, and he had to reach down and grab his camera before it crashed into the floor of the arena. So this is happening. And what we have to think deeply about is whether or not, you know, this is something that can be contained. My sense of it is, and the reason why I say it's out of their control, is I don't think they can put the genie back in the bottle on this one. And as now we're heading into the 2020 campaign, we're going to see the president having more rallies. He's already announced a couple in the coming weeks. Who's responsible for the safety of journalists at these events? The Secret Service is at these events. Trump security professionals are at these events. Are they going to be providing security and protection to journalists covering these rallies? Because my sense of it is they probably should be.
But all of this is working for Donald Trump, isn't it? I mean, as cynical as this strategy is, it in fact is working for him. We're living in this age right now, and I've said this before, kind of a golden age of journalism, where some of the best reporting that I've seen in my lifetime since Watergate is being done by some of the leading outlets, you know, whether you're talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera, or CNN or NBC News. And yet you do have this core of 40% of Americans who will discount any information that comes from those sources. So, in fact, he has immunized himself against negative reporting, negative factual reporting, investigative reporting, and he's created this media ecosystem in which he can make any claim and count on it being defended, echoed. So from his point of view, this strategy of attacking and demonizing the media is not peripheral to his political strategy. It's central to his political strategy, and it's been remarkably successful from Trump's own point of view.
No, and I think that's right. And as I write in the book, I talked on the record with Steve Bannon about this. Steve Bannon freely admits this, that the president does this because essentially he does want an adversary. And during the early months of the administration, the Democratic Party was essentially a non-factor in Washington. And so the president thought, according to Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon thought this as well, well, let's make the media the adversary and beat up on them. And so this is definitely strategic, no question about it. When I talked to a senior White House official about the use of the term the enemy of the people, that official said, well, it's meant to incite the media, not incite the public. And so they do want to draw us into this back and forth, no question about it. The question, I think, Charlie, and what this boils down to, and I describe it throughout the book as a question of what would you do, is do we just stick our heads in the sand? Do we just absorb these body blows, or do we stand up for ourselves? And my sense of it is, as reporters, we do have to stand up for ourselves, whether or not that plays into the president's hands. I think about my kids. I think about other people's kids. And sure, yes, there are Trump strategists and political strategists in Washington will say, see, aha, it works. It works for the president. But at the same time, do we want younger generations of Americans to witness a world where it's okay for the president to beat up on the press on a daily basis and nobody does anything?
Well, and also
about
beating
it.
Up on the truth. To a certain extent, he's kind of broken the journalistic model, right? I mean, the journalistic model that used to be that you would cover a news story, report what's happened. But what do you do with the president who will flagrantly lie over and over and over again? Now, I want you to tell me one story. I know it's in your book that it's very interesting, where you are. This is right after Charlottesville. Certainly one of the high low spots of the first few years, where he has a press conference where he's going back and forth, where there's blame on both sides. What struck me about it is that when you had a chance to question the president, you didn't actually ask him a question. You went sort of back and forth with declarative sentences. So just tell me that story from your point of view.
Sure. And, throughout the book, I tried to, Charlie, inject from here, here and there, portions of transcripts so people can see how these back and forths work out verbatim, because people don't recognize how much he interrupts us. They say, well, Jim, you're interrupting the president all the time. Look who is interrupting who, as I'll say about that. But yes, at that press conference at Trump Tower, keep in mind, the president on the Saturday of when Charlottesville happened, that was when he blamed many sides. And then a couple of days later, he had a chance to clean things up. And that was when he finally condemned white supremacists, condemned neo-Nazis. We had an exchange on that day. But it wasn't until Trump Tower where he really, I think, revealed some of his true colors on this subject. He was starting to say that, that there was blame to go around. And I interjected and I said, Mr. President, the neo-Nazis started this. And that is when he said, there are very fine people on both sides. And I interrupted again, and I said, there are no fine people in the Nazis. And the way I talk about it in the book, Charlie, is basically this. There aren't two sides to a story when it's a matter of right versus wrong. Like, can you imagine a situation where a reporter is saying, well, Mr. President, isn't it true that maybe some Nazis are, we're just, what kind of road are we going down at that point? I think we've reached a point in American society, thank goodness, where we can all universally agree that Nazis are bad people. So I don't need to put that in the form of a question. And now the president's people get very hot and bothered about this. And they say, well, he eventually said during that press conference that he condemns white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Well, how many times does it take it, Charlie, for the president of the United States to get this one right? I think when you're president, this is one you got to get right on the first try.
Well, this, of course, then your critics would say, but you're not questioning the president. You are actually debating him. So it's in an event like this, the president of the United States is making statements and you are arguing with him. Is that the role of the media, to argue with the president, to actually debate the president? or does that make you too much part of the story?
Well, I don't do it on every occasion, and I guess the rare occasions where I did or have done that, I suppose that is when, you know, these sorts of episodes have come up that people have said, "Hey, wait a minute, Jim, what are you doing here?" You know, not that anybody wants to exhaust themselves doing this, but I would invite people to go and look at transcripts and go back. And if they're curious about this, I don't do that, you know, in every interaction that I have with the president or press secretary. But having said that, you know, take the news conference that happened after the midterms, when I asked the president if I could, you know, talk to him about his claim that that this caravan of migrants coming towards the border was an invasion. It wasn't an invasion. And so, you know, if you ask the question, well, Mr. President, what was it, not an invasion? Or, you know, how can you call it an invasion? You know, I mean, it wasn't an invasion. So at some point, like you said, the president plays so fast and loose with the facts that he makes it difficult for journalists. To some extent, and I talk about this in the book, when you have a new kind of president in this fashion, you need a new kind of playbook. And I don't think he's playing by the old rules either. And so there may be times when you have to fact check him in real time at a press conference. And I don't think that's stepping outside your lane as a reporter.
Okay, so the rest of the media, is the rest of the media going by the old playbook, or have they adjusted the playbook as well? Talk about your colleagues. Are you an outlier, or are the other members of the media recognizing we just can't simply ask a question, have the president lie, and then move on to the next question?
You know, Charlie, I think that you saw some of that happen during Sarah's term as press secretary, where, you know, she was essentially passing on false information in the briefing room from time to time, and you would see other White House correspondents call her out on that. So I'm hardly the only person doing it, and I lay that out on several occasions throughout the book. I try to include other colleagues of mine who have done the same thing. And I think that, you know, I do think that serves us well. You know, we can't simply roll over when this administration is going to be playing fast and loose with the facts in that fashion. You know, Sarah Sanders is going to go down as a press secretary who acknowledged to, you know, federal investigators in the Mueller report as somebody who, you know, was passing on false information in the White House briefing room. You know, she admitted that she passed on false information to reporters. And so they thrust us into this position, Charlie, where we have to fact check them sometimes right to their faces.
So why did they stop having the daily briefing? And should anyone outside of the press corps care about that?
You know, my sense of it is that, and I write about this, the president wanted to sort of take control of the message over at the White House. He's been his own communications director at times, and to some extent, he's his own press secretary. He wanted to end those briefings, is what I understand from my reporting. But having said all of that, I do think that Sarah Sanders was running into a situation in those press briefings where she may have been putting herself in legal jeopardy. There were a couple of occasions where she was just flat out telling false information, giving false information to reporters. And as we saw in the Mueller report, she was being asked about that. And so, you know, I don't think it was serving them well having her go out there and, you know, BSing the public on a regular basis. The sad reality is, Charlie, what we have now, instead of these briefings, we have these driveway gaggles of the, you know, lawn of the White House, where Kellyanne Conway or whoever would go out and do an exclusive interview, typically with Fox News, and then head back towards the White House and then stop on the driveway. And if they have time, take a few questions from reporters. We've only had two or three briefings in the White House briefing room all year this year. And, you know, it's stunning to me that you have all of these taxpayer funded employees working in the press shop for the White House. And we have a White House briefing room that has essentially become what I like to call the cafeteria, because it's just a place where the crews eat their lunch now.
Okay, so we can talk about 2020, but I want to just flash back to 2016. And one of the extraordinary stories that I think historians are going to puzzle over is the role the media played back in 2016 of giving so much airtime, unedited free airtime, to Donald Trump. In retrospect, wasn't that an egregious example of media malpractice to just turn over? And I'm not talking about just CNN. Obviously, everybody, you know, across the board gave exponentially more coverage to Donald Trump than to any other candidate. And it's hard to imagine his success without that air, that that kind of free air. Maybe it was more than $1 billion. I've seen estimates, but that was media malpractice, wasn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, Charlie, I thought deeply about this, and my sense of it is, and CNN executives, other executives across the industry have recognized this, is that there probably was too much coverage given to the rallies, airing these rallies end to end. I think you're going to see less of that heading into 2020. I think what you're going to see is, especially with the president's rallies, you're going to see perhaps not live coverage, but going to the correspondent after the rally is over, or going to a fact checker after the rally is over and saying, what did the president get right? What did he get wrong? Because as we've seen with this president, you can't just give him gobs and gobs of airtime unedited because he just is not wedded to the facts. He's not wedded to the truth. And so I do think you're going to see a change in coverage from that standpoint. But the other thing I'll point out, Charlie, and I'm not trying to be an apologist for my industry or anything like that. Remember, Donald Trump was the Republican frontrunner, as you'll remember, Charlie, almost the entire process. Mm-hmm. And so the question becomes, do you not cover the frontrunner because he's saying these outlandish and outrageous things? My guess is that, if we had to do it all over again, perhaps we wouldn't give as much coverage. But at the same time, it's hard to deny more coverage to somebody who is the frontrunner. I mean, this is somebody who has attacked arenas and saying the most outrageous things. And, it was a sight to behold. I was there at those rallies. And it's hard to imagine how we could not have covered this, given the fact that he was essentially running the table from the beginning of the process.
But that's how he sees the news cycle for the last 3 years, right? By saying outrageous things. And by the time we get the outrage machines going about that, he said something else that is outrageous or something that is false. So he has been, to use the cliche, sucking the oxygen out of the room, year after year, day after day. What are we missing? Let's take a step back here. While we are all obsessing about the latest gaffe or outrage or tweet by Donald Trump, the world is going on, and there are so many other major stories that in Earth 2.0 we would really be focusing on. Do you worry about what we are not talking about, what we are not covering because we have become so obsessed by the serial outrages of Donald Trump?
I do worry about that. And, the Trump people have figured this out, just to finish answering the previous question. They saw during the 2016 campaign how he could command the coverage. Steve Bannon, in my book, refers to him as the Marshall McLuhan candidate because he understood that the media is the message. And, they thought that mastering the daily news cycle meant mastering that race. But putting all that aside, yes, I mean, there are certainly some stories out there that we need to be covering more. But a lot of them tend to be connected to what's happening in the White House right now. Look what's happening down on the border. My God, what are we going to say 5, 10, 15 years from now about what's happening to these kids in these detention facilities? I think that there could be a lot more coverage devoted to that. Why aren't news organizations demanding that we get access to these facilities? Something needs to be done about that. I do think that when I talk to my kids, or when I talk to, audiences with a lot of young people, college kids, high school kids, that universally, almost every time, Charlie, the subject that comes up is climate change. Younger people are clamoring for more coverage of climate change issues. And I know that you have a conservative audience, and maybe they may, shrug their shoulders at that. But a lot of young people are really focused in on that issue. And I do think as we go on here, we're going to have to be devoting more coverage to that because it's something that our younger viewers, listeners, and readers are demanding.
Do you think that Donald Trump's going to be reelected next year?
My sense of it is that he won't. And I've finished making predictions. In the 2016 campaign, when Access Hollywood came out, I basically said that that was it. He was finished as a candidate. And they thought so, too. As I write in the book, Ryan's Priebus came up to me and basically said, it's going to take a miracle for us to win. Didn't you think we were done after Access Hollywood? Donald Trump does seem to have nine lives or 9,000 lives or whatever it is. But look at the metrics, look at the data, look what happened during the 2018 midterms. He ran against the media. He ran against immigrants. It didn't work out for him. When you saw the numbers come in after the midterm results were tabulated, it turned out that the Democrats won the national vote by some 8 percentage points. And midterms, as you know, Charlie, tend to favor Republicans. And so in that kind of landscape for the Democrats to do that well, it says to me that not only was there a blue wave, I mean, Donald Trump got his clock cleaned. Those dynamics have not altered fundamentally heading into 2020. If anything, the playing field is getting more difficult for him. And so I would think at this point, if the Democrats were to settle on an electable candidate and, don't pull
a big if, or
something like that, then they should be able to defeat him. But we've seen this movie before. We've heard all the bad predictions before. As a matter of fact, at the Trump rallies, one of the things that they do now is they play these montages, these highlights reels of various people in Washington predicting that Donald Trump was going to lose. And so they do feed off of that, and they'll do it again heading into 2020.
See, here's my concern about this. You have this new Washington Post ABC poll that shows that his approval rating is up to 47% among registered voters. You extrapolate to some of the swing states he needs to win in the Electoral College. And, Henry Olson writes in the Washington Post that would suggest that the president should be favored. And then, of course, you have that big if about the Democrats. You mentioned the midterm elections. They won those midterm elections with centrist candidates in places like Texas and Oklahoma and Orange County. And yet we're focusing on the AOCs of the world, and you have a Democratic field that seems to be appealing to the left wing of the party, not the people like the Connor Lambs or the Abigail Spanbergers, who in fact won in the special election. So are you at all, concerned that the Democrats have created their own blue bubble and that they are taking positions that, in fact, are going to make it very difficult to beat Donald Trump? I mean, there are a lot of the positions they've taken that if Donald Trump, again, was sitting in the White House saying, this is what I'd like to run against, these are the people, this is what I'd like them to say, they're saying it, aren't they?
Well, inside the White House, they are getting a little giddy over their prospects. I will say that when they look at some of the debate that's happening out there. My sense of it, Charlie, when I talk to Democratic voters, I see them from time to time at some of these events on the book tour. There is more of a desire, I think, for sanity than socialism. And I think that some of this, left of center politics is not going to work in a general election. I think you're going to see, especially in those blue wall states that Donald Trump took in 2016, there's just, I think, very little appetite for that as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And I was out there talking to those folks. Those voters are much more concerned about job security, retirement security, those kinds of issues than they are about, free college for all. Some of these issues that appeal to much younger voters who don't always turn out in these elections, as you know. But I remember, Charlie, covering the 2008 race and how Barack Obama, really ran to the left of Hillary Clinton. He really touted himself as an anti-war candidate and didn't really back away from that posture very much during the general election battle. And so I also think that candidates matter. I think charisma and that sort of thing matters. And so, I'm not saying that the Democratic Party needs to go to the factory and try to manufacture another Barack Obama. But those kinds of candidates, transformational candidates, do tend to be more successful in these general election battles. And I covered John Kerry in 2004, more of an establishment figure, not exactly the most inspiring public official out there. I covered Mitt Romney in 2012, another establishment figure. Those types of politicians, some may argue that Joe Biden is that kind of politician. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those types of politicians aren't always successful in these general election campaigns, and these transformational figures like Barack Obama and Donald Trump are. And so I do think the Democrats are in a bit of a fix right now. They do, I think, have to. Yes, I do think they need to be concerned about moving or drifting too far to the left. That I think they need to be focused on, if they want to be successful, finding a candidate who is going to electrify their base in the way that Donald Trump electrifies his.
I should have asked you this question earlier when we were talking about the book, The Enemy of the People. One of the episodes in your back and forth with the Trump administration that I think is often cited when people talk about the threat to the freedom of the press was when they took away your hard card. Is that what it's called, the press pass? They eventually had to back down. So just tell us the story of and why it is important that the White House not be able to pick and choose which reporters cover the White House.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, Charlie, this goes back to that midterm election, the day after the midterm results came in and Republicans lost the House. President Trump was not in a very good mood. And when he called on me, we went back and forth over his claim on a caravan. You saw the intern come in for the microphone. I didn't want to give up the microphone. And
you were hanging on to that microphone.
I was hanging on to that microphone. I didn't want to give it up. As Ronald Reagan once said, I paid for that microphone. No, I'm just kidding. I went about my business the rest of the day and did my stories and my live shots and left the White House grounds for that evening to go get some dinner. And I came back and looked at the notification on my phone that flashed that said I had my hard pass suspended. And it wasn't a note to me. It was a note to the entire world from Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary. And then later on that night, as we all remember, they tried to bolster their case by releasing this doctored video that showed me karate chopping, the karate chop, this intern who got thrust into this through no fault of her own. And that was sort of a 1984 Orwellian moment for me. But CNN didn't waver. We took the administration to court. And one of the most amazing things about that case, and people sort of thought, well, this is a case of, will Jim get his press pass back? It was much more than that. Taxpayer-funded lawyers, Justice Department lawyers, paid for with your tax dollars, went into court, federal court, arguing on behalf of the White House that the president can pick and choose whoever he wants covering his administration. That essentially, if they didn't like the coverage, they could come up to you and tell you to get lost. And my goodness, do we want a situation like that in this country where an administration can do that? As I remind my friends in conservative media, Republicans, you guys don't get to be in power forever. So, a Democratic administration could easily come in and say, we're going to do the same thing that Donald Trump did to CNN. We don't want a situation like that where it just goes back and forth and people kicking out reporters out of the White House. That's not the type of coverage that I think the American people expect. And so fortunately, the judge came down on our side. But one of the things that was just so revealing to me in that case was the attitude that this administration has about the press, that we are sort of disposable, that, we can be discarded at any moment. That is not what was intended when the framers put in the Constitution, our First Amendment rights. They wanted reporters in there not just to cover presidential administrations, but I think from time to time to irritate and annoy them a little bit. John Kennedy once gave a speech to a group of newspaper publishers in the early days of his administration. And one of the things that John Kennedy said that, about the role of the press is that we're there not just to cover the news, not just to report on what people want to hear, but in some occasions to incite public anger, to anger the public, is what he talked about. And it's because of that role of the press that we know about things like family separations down at the border and so on. So if you have an administration that's able to pick and choose who covers what, in my view, you don't really have freedom of the press anymore. And at that point, this really ceases to be the United States of America that you and I grew up in. And I'm not ready to give that up yet.
So what are you expecting from Bob Mueller's testimony next week? It was interesting that the Attorney General came out and said that there was going to be a spectacle, and if Mueller wanted some help in fighting the subpoenas, he'd be willing to have the Department of Justice. I mean, is this going to be a letdown, or is this going to be a kind of a Watergate style moment? How big a story is it going to be next week?
Well, Robert Mueller is a very careful individual, and I, as I wrote in the book, and I wrote this, I'll have before the Mueller report ever came out. It was always my suspicion that he was never really going to present a case that resulted in the president being booted out of office. I just, unless it was just an airtight, bulletproof type of case, I just didn't think, from what I knew about Robert Mueller, that he was going to bring that kind of case before the American people. Of course, we didn't know. He might have done that. But my guess is when he goes up to Capitol Hill and he presents his information to lawmakers, that he is going to be just as careful and just as cautious as he was that day when he gave that that statement to the press. He's going to stick to what's in his report. I do think the one thing, Charlie, that we have not focused in on enough is the warning that Robert Mueller gave to the American people that day he spoke to the press, when he said that it is our conclusion, it is the conclusion of the Justice Department Special Counsel Office, that the Russians interfered in 2016, that they tried to meddle in our political process, and this food fight over Donald Trump has completely obscured that, I think. And my guess is that we may hear more from Robert Mueller in that regard. And that may be the most beneficial thing of all in terms of what he has to say, because I don't think we've focused in on that enough. And I'm not sure lawmakers up on Capitol Hill have really taken, I mean, do you think, Charlie, have they really done enough to protect this political process from being meddled with in the next election? What's stopping the Russians from doing it again? My goodness.
Well, those are the key questions. And of course, the fact is they have not read the report. And I think next week we're going to get a reminder, if we needed it, of the power of television over the power of a 500-page book. Jim Acosta, thank you so much for joining me. The book is The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Jim Acosta, of course, is CNN's veteran chief White House correspondent. Thanks for spending so much time with us today.
Really appreciate the time, Charlie. Thanks so much.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.